Mark Pesce, tech commentator. Hello, Mark. Season's greetings.
Hello, Catherine.
Let's have a look at the year in review. From your perspective, what have been some of the biggest stories?
I think the story that's probably touched the most people is the semiconductor shortage. So this really has its roots back in 2020. It looks like a lot of car makers, because they saw no one buying cars during the peak of the first wave of the pandemic, they canceled some orders, and then things came roaring back later on in the year. They tried to make the orders and they couldn't get the chips that they needed. And the people who had the chips started to realize that there was going to be a shortage, and so they started to overbuy. Basically, they started to hoard chips. So what normal people did with toilet paper, people did who were ordering chips. And this created, I guess you could say, a cascading number of shortages, which then meant that it took longer and longer and longer between the time a company would order chips to put into your car and those chips actually arriving. And now these times are out to, and they've grown consistently over 2021, to 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And this has meant that most of the major car manufacturers in the world cannot build all the cars they want to build right now because they're missing some. And these are not complicated chips. These are not the big chips in your smartphones. They're little what they call microcontrollers, little brains that might control, say, the braking on the car or perhaps how the windshield wipers operate. It's these chips that are built into cars these days that are in extremely short supply. And so that has meant that you can't necessarily get the smartphone you want, you can't get the car that you want, you can't get the laptop that you want, because a lot of these support chips are simply not available anymore.
What has been the impact? We saw the actual production being ramped back for a time. Has it eased at all or got more acute, Mark?
It has tended to get more acute over this year. You can even see, even Apple, which is, you know, first off, by market capitalization, the biggest company in the world, one of the biggest consumers of semiconductors in the world. They introduced brand new laptop models in the final quarter of this year, and they're all completely sold out. And Apple hates that. Apple always wants to make sure that every customer can walk into a store and walk out with the machine. They never want to tell a customer to wait. And so if you're saying to the biggest company in the world, sorry, you've got to get at the end of the queue, then you can tell how severe it is. What that has meant is that all of the semiconductor companies in the world have now pushed a lot of money into building new plants. Now, the semiconductor industry has typically overinvested and then collapsed and then overinvested and then collapsed. And I think they all thought they were going to be wise this time and held back on investment. That landed them here, where demand really greatly exceeded their capacity and their supply. So we saw in this calendar year, $100 billion get invested, but over the next 5 years, $500 billion is being invested mostly in the US, Japan, South Korea, and a bit in Europe to build new capacity. And that will clear this backlog. But the sting and the tail here is it takes a long time to build a semiconductor fabrication plant. Most of these plants won't be online until at the earliest, the beginning of 2023. And that means that the backlog doesn't clear until 2024 or 2025.
Indeed. So that is a biggie. And again, the backlog is one thing, but the question is whether this is going to repeat at some stage. Do we think it is a one-off?
So if history is any guide, it probably will happen again. These tend to happen sort of once a decade in the semiconductor industry. This is by far the worst. And part of the reason is because chips are in everything now, right? Even a decade ago, chips weren't in everything. But pretty much everything has chips in it now. And so a semiconductor shortage doesn't affect one industry. It's not just computer gear or networking equipment or whatever it might be. It is now pretty much everything. And so you'd have to think that we will be much more careful about managing supply and managing our manufacturing capacity going forward, because it's seen not just as a business prerogative, but it's now seen as a national security prerogative.
How quickly will those new chip foundries take to come on? $500 billion, that's a lot of investment. Yeah. And as we've said, learning from this, that investment in supply is happening on several continents, right? On three at least. And how long to bring them up to speed? You're saying 2025, and presumably quite an acute problem, particularly in the next couple of years.
Yes. And so things will start to get better a bit by the end of next year. I think people are clear on that. And those lead times will come in. The simpler chips that the car manufacturers are using should be in plentiful supply. And we'll touch wood on that by the second half of next year. And so the car manufacturing will be back up to normal. But when you start talking about the more sophisticated chips that you find in laptops and in smartphones and in high performance computing in the cloud, that's the stuff that's still going to take probably 2 years, maybe 3 years, until there's really sufficient supply.
All right, second big theme of the year.
So just this time last year, Christmas time last year, there was a lot of reports about this thing called the solar winds hack. And it seemed like it was a very big deal. And it took people actually months, well into this year, to understand what the solar winds hack was. So solar winds is a software company that makes software that helps people monitor their computer networks. And you download their software and you install it on your network and it will keep track of everything for you and let you know when there's a problem. But there was a problem with SolarWinds, because it turned out that the way SolarWinds made the software that it shipped to all of its clients was insecure. And an attacker got in and stuck some malicious software into the software that all of SolarWinds companies used. And so when they downloaded the latest update, as of course they tell you to do so you can have all the latest security packages, it installed insecure, malicious software across tens of thousands of highly secure systems used by governments, used by businesses, used by universities all around the world. And the attackers were basically able to read and possibly manipulate the files of all of these very secure systems. And we call this a supply chain hack because what it's doing is it's getting the bad software into the supply chain that all of these folks are using as a matter of course. You could think of it, you get a regular update if you have Google or if you have an Apple smartphone, you get a regular operating system update. If there was bad software in that update, it would corrupt all of those hundreds of millions and billions of smartphones. And this is exactly what this did. And it did it at a massive scale so that it opened up all of these systems. And what it does is it exposes the fact that the more software you use in your business, the more careful you have to be about the chain of custody of that software. Every step along the way, you have to be assured that someone's not coming in and trying to poison it and then have you literally spread the poison when your customers update their software using your poisoned software.
Eek.
Yes. Yes, and because we are all using so much software that is built by other people, and just over the last month, there's been another supply chain poisoning on something called Log4j. Log4j, you would never heard of. It turns out it's built into Minecraft. And of course, hundreds of millions of kids around the world play Minecraft all the time. It's just a little program that allows the computer to log things that are going on when you're running the program. But it turns out it actually had some insecurity in it, which meant that someone could send a message to your computer that would take control of your computer. This was found about a month ago. And of course, the problem is it's not just in Minecraft. It's used in hundreds of millions of computers around the world, particularly because it was done in Java, which is a language that banks like to use to run their banking systems. Particularly many financial systems around the world were suddenly vulnerable to being taken over. So there are a lot of individuals who are working through the holidays right now patching this. Again, it's a supply chain bug, but it was a vulnerability that wasn't there because someone maliciously put it in there. It was a weakness that was suddenly discovered, and it was realized that that weakness exposed millions of systems.
Well, that's the one that is the big one right now, isn't it? And we're hearing it, that it's affecting so many systems and is a vulnerability beyond, not beyond precedent, but fairly significant. And the problem is the patches don't necessarily work, correct?
Yes, the first patch for Log4j was like, oh, this is the fix. Oh, wait, no, there's another vulnerability. And this has happened, I think, three times now. And so what people need to do is when the vulnerability is discovered, they do need to start fixing it, but they also need to stay aware. They can't just think that they fixed it and they're done. They have to consider it as being a very dynamic situation and that it will take some time for that to settle out. And of course, that means that people have to pay attention, because if they don't, then they've actually probably made their system at least as, if not more, vulnerable than it was before.
I've seen some criticism of open source, not so much criticism of open source itself, but of the use of open source as being an exacerbator of this vulnerability. And the other thing, of course, is being able to track back to who wrote the software in the first place. Does this show that the software issue, the software vulnerability, is specific in this instance to Log4Jam, but actually the whole infrastructure underneath it is vulnerable?
What it definitely says is that if you are a commercial company and you're using open source software, you have a responsibility to do your due diligence, to understand who's making that software, how they're making it, how they're being supported for making it, and in fact, offer them the assistance they need to be able to consistently do a good job with that. People think that open source software is free, and in one sense, it's free to use, but that doesn't mean it's free to create. And so there's a shared responsibility here. And I think what Log4j is actually showing us is that that shared responsibility has a real bottom line impact. If you don't invest in the people who are creating your free software, they will not be creating the software that could be as good as you need.
All right. And number three for 2021, the big themes in tech, what would it be?
There was a recent vote on the worst company in the world. Catherine, can you guess who won?
Facebook.
You got it in one.
That literally was a guess.
Yeah.
I hadn't read to these parts of the notes. Worst company judged by what?
It was a survey that was done by Yahoo Finance, right? They select a company of the year. And it's based, again, on its performance and its achievements of the year to tell us sort of which company is definitely getting the worst credit in the world for their activities. And you have to think, look, Facebook has had a pretty horrendous year. In September, the Wall Street Journal started publishing the Facebook papers. We know that these were leaked by Francis Hagan, who came forward a little bit later as a whistleblower. It showed that definitively Facebook knew that Instagram was ruinous to the mental health, particularly of teenage girls. They knew why it was, and they didn't fix anything about it. And so this is, and again, Facebook and particularly Instagram's leadership has been called in front of Congress to sort of justify this. And there was a comment from the head of Instagram basically saying that, you know, just as, well, you know, cars kill people and we still use cars because they're really good. Well, Instagram kills people, but it's really a social good. So, and he literally said this, right? He said this out loud. Didn't say this to Congress because I don't think it would be good, but he said it in the media. So they're sort of justifying the fact that Instagram essentially makes young women feel worthless in its design as, collateral damage. So that was the first one. Then it was very clear that, and again, in another one of the papers, that Facebook is complicit in accelerating or amplifying racial, perhaps even genocidal violence by basically not doing enough to cancel the accounts that are well known for inciting racial hatred. This is, I think, particularly in South Asia. And earlier this month, Rohingya refugees filed a $200 billion lawsuit against Facebook, basically charging that they had a defective product that led to wrongful death, personal injury, pain, suffering, emotional stress, and so on in the ethnic cleansing that's currently underway in Myanmar that is being amplified and accelerated by Facebook. And then there was the whole story about how Facebook dealt with all of the news around the presidential election in the United States last year, which of course was the thing that was obsessing us this time last year, and how Facebook was sort of not trying to clamp down on the conspiracy theories as they were being spread. And this is because Facebook had really leaned from 2015 into this idea that negative posts, posts that make people angry, turns out that's the secret of Facebook success. The angrier you are on Facebook, the more you're engaged with Facebook. It is actually not all pictures of kittens. It's things that make you angry keep you on Facebook. The engineers found out that they were making people angry. They could see it in their metrics, and they said, we have to fix this. And they were overruled by Mark Zuckerberg, who said, if we do that, it will drop user engagement. We're going to opt to keep them angry.
He's not the only one, you know. Guillaume, and I'm not remember his surname, was a working with YouTube back in about 2013, 2014, I think, when he pointed out to YouTube that their algorithms drove people to more and more extreme content. The algorithms were told to do one thing, just keep people online as long as possible. But the byproduct was, and this was human nature, that what keeps us online the longest is more and more extreme material of whatever we're watching, including more and more radical material of whatever we're watching. And he proposed to YouTube a fix for this, a fix for the algorithm, and he got the sack. Yeah. So it's not a new problem.
No. No, and this is I think what makes it even more embarrassing, makes it even more clear that they are the worst company in the world, that this phenomenon had been identified. And that this clearly, I mean, if this isn't answered either with regulation or with civil lawsuits, and probably some combination of them, I feel like that's probably the only way we're going to be able to get our hand on this, so that people do not release systems for the public to use that are designed in this way. Right? That we have to consider that it's not just the service that's being offered. It's how that service then affects the emotional health of the people who are using it. And it feels like we're going to probably have to develop some metrics, some testing around that, so we can have data that can show actually you need to adjust your system because your system is making people angrier. And we need to think about how to design that system in a way that it doesn't accelerate that.
And do we think this has anything to do with Facebook's name change this year?
I think it probably has everything to do. We know that Mark Zuckerberg has been obsessed with the metaverse, which is, you can think of it as an online 3D environment that has everyone on it. So all 2.5 billion Facebook's users all inside a quote-unquote immersive 3D environment. We know that he's had his eye on that for a number of years. But the fact that he basically had his meeting with investors in which he was talking about all of the, or basically fending off all of the trouble that he had gotten himself into and the company into by saying, oh, we're going to make this big change. And then 3 days later, announcing that change, he effectively managed to change the entire conversation from, oh my God, this is the worst company in the world, to, wait, what's this metaverse thing? Oh, wow. What's Facebook doing? Oh, wow. It's really different. And so, in terms of being able to take the tech press, who was probably tired of talking about how bad Facebook is, and giving them something else to talk about, it worked really well, because we are talking less about how Facebook is bad, and now we're talking more about how the metaverse is this weird new frontier.
Yeah, we're not, well, we are suckers, aren't we, really? But we're not that big a sucker. Do you put your crystal ball on for a moment? I think you already predicted that Meta will be the worst company winner in 2022 on the same award. But do you see any prospect of serious moves on regulation, or perhaps an advance of its self-regulation from these companies next year? Or are they just too big to mess with?
Look, I feel like self-regulation is that ship has already sailed. If they haven't self-regulated at this point, they're not going to, right? We're actually seeing some moves toward regulation happening in Australia next year. I wonder if they'll be able to get anything through Congress around this. I think as the January 6th congressional hearings continue, we'll learn more about how social media had played into that and take a look at that. It doesn't feel as though there is a strong consensus in America around this yet. It does feel as though there's a strong consensus in the EU and perhaps in Australia and a few other countries. So it looks like we may see some legislation around these areas, but these companies are multinational. It's not clear how they can run one algorithm in America and then another algorithm in Australia. I suspect we'll see them try, but I don't know if we know what the effects of that will be, and I don't know if they won't find some other clever way around it.
Happy Christmas to you, Mark, and we'll see what 2022 brings on all fronts. There'll be plenty of surprises, no doubt. Thank you for your time.
Happy Christmas.
Tech commentator Mark Pesce.